good films are made from these books, and good films have been made from my books. But in a way, it just doesn't touch me. You know, I've gone on 9 books past Lonesome Dove. I can't be worrying about it.
You've been listening to a 1994 interview with the late Larry McMurtry, author of Lonesome Dove and other novels, while he was on tour for the novel Pretty Boy Floyd. Neither Pretty Boy Floyd nor Father Knows Best were ever filmed. My co-host was Richard A. Lupoff, and I'm Richard Walensky on Bookwaves. Bookwaves is produced by Richard Walensky in the studios of KPFA Pacifica Radio in Berkeley, California.
Andy Warhol looks a scream, hang him on my wall. Andy Warhol, silver screen, can't tell them apart at all.
My name's Joseph Gallivan, and you're listening to Art Focus on KBOO Portland. My guest this week is Julia Dolan. She is the Minor White Curator of Photography at the Portland Art Museum, and she's here to talk about Ansel Adams in Our Time, a show about the photographer Ansel Adams, which opens to members on April 28th and to the general public on May the 5th by timed ticket. And it closes August 1st, 2021. Thanks very much for doing Art Focus by Zoom, Julia.
Thank you so much for the invitation.
Yeah, welcome back to the show. You always give us a great insight into what you're up to at the museum and the photography department. And this time you have a real big show. It's come from the Museum of Fine Arts in Boston, Ansel Adams in Our Time. Just tell us, you know, the show is about the great photographer, but in our time, what does that subtitle mean?
It means that Ansel Adams is a magnificent, incredible, and very, very important photographer of the American landscape from the 20th century, but he is not the only photographer of the American West. So while there are approximately 100 photographs by Ansel Adams, made by him, taken, printed by him in the exhibition, there are also an additional approximately 80 photographs that demonstrate the work of a few photographers who were making images in these spaces before Ansel, and then the many photographers who are thinking about the Western landscape today and how they interpret those spaces. So yes, you will get a great and wonderful overview of the beloved Ansel Adams, but also a deeper dive into the many issues and topics that were important to him and how additional people have interpreted these lands.
Mm-hmm. I was surprised to find out that he was an only child, and he was kind of lucky. His parents took him from San Francisco to Yosemite each summer when he was a teenager. So he discovered the grand nature of Yosemite Valley and photography kind of at the same time. So from the beginning, he was a landscape photographer in a sense.
Yes, certainly in a sense. He is someone who came from a middle to upper middle class family. And so he had the benefits of those types of privileges, which included leisure travel in the summer. And his parents introduced him to Yosemite, which was becoming an important leisure and camping spot in, you know, the early teens. And so by 1916, he took his first trip there, and his father gave him a Brownie Kodak camera, and he was enthralled with it and started thinking about how he could capture what he felt in Yosemite Valley on film.
So in those days, you know, would they go by train, or did people have cars? How did they get to Yosemite? Do you know?
I don't actually. I've never been to Yosemite myself. Much of what I know about Yosemite is through photographs, and I know a little bit about its history, but not enough to tell you how they would have gotten there.
Mm-hmm. So there is a book that kind of goes with the show. It's Making a Photographer, The Early Work of Ansel Adams by Rebecca Senf. She's also from Boston. in that book, she talks about how Adams kind of scurried off on his own and went exploring, and every year he would climb higher and higher in that valley, getting, you know, he'd walk like 10, 20 miles in a day, just to experience nature in a more extreme way, and also to take more photos. And that, tell us about how he went from that to being more of a commercial photographer. You know, he was later, he was being paid to go out, take pictures, you know, that became calendars and posters and books.
Well, he intended to be a fine art photographer, but those folks who are listening today who are fine art photographers likely know that even in today's market, it's very difficult to be only one thing if you're wanting to make a living from photography. And so in particular, back in the 20s and 30s and 40s and 50s, when there was almost no fine art photography market at all, he would have to create photographs for other reasons. But the earliest photographs that he put forth into the world were meant to be a set of fine art photographs. And he produced a portfolio of 16 prints in 1927. There were 100 of the limited edition portfolio sets. And that was his first real foray into the world of fine art photography. And the photographs do deal specifically with Yosemite Valley, and you'll be able to see all 16 of those portfolio prints in the exhibition, which is unusual. Most people, if they know about this set of prints, have not seen all 16 of them at one time.
And they're called the Parmelian prints, correct?
Parmelian prints of the High Sierras, yes.
Yeah. What does Parmelian mean?
Nothing really. It you can break down the word if you're interested and look at it in terms of its Greek origins, but it was more of a made-up word that was meant to add cachet to the title so that it may seem a little more art-worthy, but it wasn't a word that was used in the past connected to photographs.
Mm-hmm. So the Parmelian prints, they're mostly very craggy peaks, and he often has a tree in the foreground. So he's always playing with extreme contrast, I think. You know, the trees are usually silhouetted or they're very dark, and he puts a lot of sky in, which is usually very light. Then he kind of worked that way his whole life. Tell us about this particular picture, Moon and Half Dome, which probably most people have seen somewhere. It's taken in Yosemite. Half Dome is the sort of, well, I guess it's a volcanic dome that with a sheer side to it. Then it has the moon in the background. And then to the left, there's a very stark black triangle, you know, which is another cliff in the foreground. Tell us a bit about that picture. Do you know when he made it?
This was made in 1960. This is an example of his mature work. You may see hints of this in Parmelian prints, but the Parmelian prints, their effect is quite different. And that's why it's wonderful that people can see the Parmelian prints in person at the museum, because looking at them on a screen doesn't give you as much of a contrast between his earlier work and his later work. The Parmelian prints are warmer. They have larger tonal range within them. They're not as contrasty. And you can see where he's playing with composition, trying to figure out how he can capture what it is that he not only sees, but also feels in the space of Yosemite Valley. So once we're in the 1960s, when he's had approximately 25, 30 years to really work on what it is he's trying to convey through photographs, he thinks differently. And in some ways, I don't know that I would say more conceptually, but conceptually differently. He's very concerned about moving you into the image. He's also concerned about conveying feeling over maybe what the negative is recording. So this is a beautiful, but very kind of high contrast image. That speaks to the sublime nature of this incredible space, that if he were to pan outwards and not crop so tightly, you would see many other photographers and tourists standing around him. So this is his interpretation of Yosemite Valley that you or I will never see like this because of the nature of a national park and how many people visit them. So yeah, this is like the Yosemite Valley of our dreams.
Well, in that case, let's jump ahead or sideways to some other images. So in the show, there are other images by other photographers that kind of riff off Adam. And then who is the photographer who went out, took pictures of where Adams had taken pictures and then sort of expanded them and put his black and whites inside bigger color panoramas? Who is that?
So there's a pair of photographers, Mark Klett and Byron Wolf, who work together to situate Adams's photographs within the larger milieu of where they were photographing, which is what I was basically referring to a minute ago. And together they figure out exactly where he stood, as well as photographers from the 19th century like Carlton Watkins, who were also photographing in Yosemite and making pictures for sale there. So they determine where Watkins and Adams were standing, their exact cropping time of day, all these details, where the light was, so on and so forth. And then they make their own digital image of that space, mostly in panoramic form. And from there, they digitally insert photographs by Watkins and Adams into that panorama. So you can see the full field and then what it was that Watkins and Adams wanted us to see in their photographs. So it's a really wonderful way to pull back the veil on the artifice of photography, but as well as the artistry and how a good photographer can make a beautiful image that speaks to us in different ways. And there are two examples of their work in the first gallery of the exhibition. So it's a great way to start the exhibition and think about Adams in terms of not only his own vision, but the vision of additional photographers.
Yeah, I mean, it must be pretty difficult to try and even match his quality, you know, when you make a photo. If you're going to drop his work into yours, there's got to be some kind of, you know, you've got to match the resolution in some sense, or the artistry. Is that, do you think, what those two photographers were doing as well?
No, I don't think so, because I think they wanted us to understand that there is artistry that goes into this, and that photography is a complex medium, and it's not necessarily about them trying to match the majesty of an Ansel Adams modernist photograph. It's about us learning how photography is a language and that different people speak that language differently. And I think it's also really important to underscore, and you can see this in the exhibition, photographers don't have to be Ansel Adams to make an important photograph. This isn't the only way for us to look at the American West. It's critically important for us to understand the messages he held in these images. And it wasn't just this kind of wild beauty of the landscape. It was also how human beings are changing that landscape. And so that's a thread that I think is really important in the exhibition, in particular with later photographers. Adams was very concerned about the number of people who were coming into the spaces of the national parks and were bringing cars, other motorized vehicles, and kind of cutting things down or changing the landscape. He was concerned about water rights and land usage in other places and how not everything that we experience in the Western landscape is beautiful, and we actually sometimes screw it up. And so it's a wonderful doorway into having contemporary photographers deal with these issues that Ansel was worried about almost 100 years ago.
My name is Joseph Gallivan. You're listening to Art Focus on KBOO Portland. My guest this week is Julia Dolan. She's the Minor White Curator of Photography at the Portland Art Museum. She's talking about Ansel Adams in our time And that show opens at the museum on April 28th to members, and then May the 5th to the general public. There is a really interesting picture in this show by Catherine Opie, and it's a blurred, colored photo of a waterfall. Tell us, what is it called, and why is it in there?
I don't have the title at my fingertips, unfortunately, but I can tell you that this is an image that is also made in Yosemite. And Catherine will be speaking with me in June. We'll have a live Zoom event where she'll talk about this national parks work that she's currently doing. She's an amazing photographer who's a professor at UCLA, a long and wonderful history in her own photographic work. And she very wonderfully talks about what it means to photograph in the space of a national park when millions upon millions of other people have photographed there as well. And what does it mean when you're a professional photographer going into a space that Ansel Adams has in some ways overtaken by his photographs. So the photographs that we have in the exhibition that she has made are actually out of focus, number one. Number two, they're in color. We rarely see photographs by Ansel Adams in color. But what I love about them is this wonderful connection to vision and the repetitive nature of photography, and how even though we may not know exactly where this is or what's going on because it is purposely blurred, we have a pretty darn good sense that this is a waterfall image, particularly those of us who I think who live in Oregon or on the West Coast. We see these images both in our own lives, live and in person. And then we also see many, many photographs of them. And she's also very interested in the West Coast being the left coast and how it's become politicized even in that way. And she's also very interested in the fact that she is a woman making photographs in the landscape. The history of landscape photography is primarily white male. And so she's thinking through all of these things as she's making her photographs in the national parks. And we have a video of her in the exhibition speaking about this. We have five videos from contemporary artists speaking about their own work, which really adds to the exhibition.
And I think one of those artists who speaks on video is an African-American man who takes landscape pictures, but he also has a selfie where his head is under a, you know, a professional camera blanket, but you can see his bare legs. So who is that photographer?
So that is Jonathan Calm, who teaches at Stanford. We do not have a recording of him in the exhibition, unfortunately. He was an addition to the exhibition. Karen Haas, who is the curator at the Museum of Fine Arts Boston, who curated the exhibition, welcomed me to add a few photographs that might resonate with our community as well. It's really nice when you can cater an exhibition to your own communities. And I thought it was really important to bring in Black voices as well to this exhibition. And Jonathan Calm is someone who's very interested in what it means to be African American and traveling throughout this country, in particular in the West, and then what it means to be a Black man making landscape photographs in the West. So he's very interested in his own physical being and what it means to be seen within the landscape while he is making photographs. Because when I know for myself, when I think of someone under a dark cloth looking through an 8x10 camera like Ansel Adams may have, that I typically am thinking it's probably a white man doing that work. And Jonathan Calm is aware of that tradition and what it means that he disrupts that tradition.
Adam, actually, before I go on, I want to ask you, I didn't realize Adams, he photographed on glass plate quite often. And to get up there with a massive camera, he'd have like 50 pounds of glass plates. He'd have to, you know, rent a donkey, basically. Was he always like that throughout his career? Did he kind of graduate to, you know, a medium format that he could put in his backpack by the end?
Yes. he was not like that all the time. That was early on. He embraced all sorts of technology. He was very interested in all the different ways that one could make a photograph. It served its purpose for him earlier on when he was in Yosemite, but after the glass plates, he moved to film sheets. He would use 35 millimeter cameras. He would use smaller than 5x7 and 8x10 view cameras. He was very interested in Polaroid and Polaroid technology. Sometimes he made color photographs as well. So he was someone who was not at all disinterested in camera technologies and the way that cameras would change and improve. So he was someone who definitely embraced the range of camera technology and film technology and experimented with what each camera or each film or each paper could do for him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think, you know, the sort of poster image or the calendar image of his work is a dramatic weather in a huge landscape shot on large format, and this show shows different things, right? I mean, different types of imagery, but also he photographed people. So tell us about some of the people he shot in New Mexico, places like that.
Well, he certainly did make photographs of individuals throughout his career, and we don't necessarily see them all the time. There is a section in the exhibition that deals with his time in the Southwest. He loved the Southwest, in particular New Mexico and Arizona. He found the light to be very different there. And if you have been to the Southwest, you probably understand what he means. The light quality is different from other parts of the United States. And he found an all-embracing artistic community there as well. So he photographed his friends like Georgia O'Keeffe while he was there, but he also photographed the indigenous peoples, which was not uncommon and was also certainly problematic. He is a white man making photographs of peoples who have lived for centuries, if not longer, in these spaces, and during that time are continuing to be marginalized and pushed off their own lands and treated terribly by the United States government. So he is someone who is an outsider. You know, he may be a professional photographer, but he is part of that tourist class who is fascinated, unfortunately, sometimes in tokenizing ways of these very important cultures, which is not to say that he didn't understand the problems and the terrible things that the US government was pushing onto indigenous cultures. But he was an outsider in that space. And when I look at those photographs, while they are beautifully made of, you know, people in Tusuke and other locations, I can see that he's not fully invited into those spaces.
In Utah, I think he took a selfie of his own shadow on the ground. I think it's cracked lake bed kind of ground. It's either that or he's on a cliff sort of overlooking a gigantic canyon. Was this him in playful mood?
I don't know the exact story behind this image. I would guess so. Maybe it was playful. I find it very interesting from an art history lens looking forward, you know, from a number of decades later, in that he is, in some ways, through his shadow, claiming that territory as a photographer. You know, it's almost a kind of marking or naming of this space, which I find very interesting. And it also speaks a little bit to that somewhat common language of tourist photography and how those of us who are not fine art photographers often stand with the sun behind us and our long shadow ends up in the composition of whatever photograph it is we're taking.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that happens. Another picture that you got to add to the show was of the lodge at Crater Lake. Tell us a bit about that picture.
The photograph that features Crater Lake Lodge is part of Jonathan Kalm's series dealing with the Green Book, which was the very, very important yearly publication for African-American motorists that was published between 1936 and 1966, which would outline for Black folks where they could stay overnight, where they could use the restroom, where not to get stuck in a sundown town where they would be allowed to purchase food or gas. And so Jonathan is very, very interested in what the Green Book demonstrated and offered to people throughout the United States. And lately he has been photographing locations in the American West, and Crater Lake Lodge first appeared there in the book in 1957 as a place for Black folks to be able to rest safely.
Is that early 1957 or late, do you think?
Well, the national parks have a very complex history with racism and access. And you will find that even though they were technically desegregated, I believe after World War II, the actual desegregation and the actual feeling of being welcome in a national park and seeing people who look like you is a continuing journey. And surveys indicate that the number of folks of color who utilize the national park spaces even today are exceedingly, exceedingly low. They tend to be very white spaces to this day.
Is there anything else that jumps out at you from the show that you'd like the listener to know about before they come and see it?
What I'm really excited for people to see when they come to this exhibition is not only the glory of the American West as seen through Ansel Adams's lens and other photographers' lenses as well, but also the opportunity to engage with the distinct realities of our lives on these lands here in Oregon, in California, in Washington. And some of the final photographs that you will see in the exhibition, both by Adams and by other artists, is the landscape that's been destroyed and is then being reborn through forest fires. And that is something that is so, so close to home, particularly after the past couple of years, to those of us who live in and around Portland. So Ansel offers us an opportunity to open and continue conversations that he was having nearly 100 years ago. Those conversations are not yet closed. We have not solved any of the issues that Ansel has brought up. And so while we get to glory in this incredible landscape, we also need to remind ourselves that we need to be better at being stewards of these lands and caretakers.
My name's Joseph Gallivan. You've been listening to Art Focus on KBOO Portland. My guest this week was Julia Dolan. She's the Minor White Curator of Photography at the Portland Art Museum. And Julia was talking about Ansel Adams In Our Time. The show opens April 28th to members and then May the 5th to the general public on a time ticket. And it closes August 1st, 2021. Thank you so much for doing Art Focus by Zoom, Julia.
Thank you.
Andy Warhol looks a scream. Hang him on my wall. Andy Warhol, silver screen. Can't tell them apart at all.
Estás escuchando KBO.
Bienvenidos a un breve informativo en su estación comunitaria KBOO 90.7 FM. Hoy martes 6 de abril del 2000.